Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My next guest is Lonnie Liston Smith. Lonnie is a jazz legend. He's a pianist and keyboard player. He's worked with Pharoah Sanders, Miles Davis, Marvin Gaye. He's a master of the Fender Rhodes. That's the electric piano that helped define a movement in music that eventually became known as cosmic jazz. You can hear exactly what I mean in one of his most iconic tracks, Summer Nights. Cosmic jazz is, as they say, having a moment. A moment that has lasted, I don't know, maybe 10 years now? You can hear it in the jazz vanguard being led by artists like Kamasi Washington and Terrace Martin. You can hear it in the beats of hip-hop producers like The Alchemist and Flying Lotus. You can hear it sampled on tracks from Benny the Butcher and Kendrick Lamar. It's been 25 years since Lonnie Liston Smith released his last solo record. He's toured. He's seen the occasional royalty check come through for compilations or yet another sample. But this year, for the first time in a quarter century, Lonnie dropped a new record. Jazz is Dead 17 is part of a series of albums released by musicians who are collaborating with the producers Adrian Young and Ali Shaheed Muhammad. It's a vibrant record, full of energy, still pushing boundaries. Lonnie Liston Smith is 82 and still in top form. I want to play you a little bit of this so you can hear it. This is Cosmic Changes, which features vocals from Lauren Oden. Liston Smith, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
All right, Jesse, it's great to be here.
And congratulations on this great record. I really was enjoying it.
Wow, okay. It's a very interesting story.
Yeah, so you hadn't recorded a record under your own name in a long time. How did you end up doing this one?
Jesse, like I said, this is a really interesting story because, you know, I'm sitting at home over here on the East Coast. So I get a call from Drew. I think he's one of the owners of Jazz Is Dead Records. He said, we'd like to record you. So I said, well, I said, Jazz Is Dead. And then he said, we just recorded Gary Botts, Gene Kahn, Roy Ayers. I said, okay. And in a way, I just got back from London. I said, wow, I really don't want to come to California, way over there right now. He said, no, we're gonna record you. And plus, we're going to do a concert. So you get paid for the recording, you do a concert. And then, you know, we'll take good care of you when you come to California. So, okay, so I go. But I had no idea how they did things. And I had never, then when I got there, he introduced me to Adrian and Ali. And they have a 70s studio. I mean, all 70s equipment. I mean, the keyboards, everything. And I think everything is analog. And so, and in the studio, it was just myself, bass and drums. And it had these little motifs and ideas. And they said, okay, we want you to develop it and just play, be yourself. And when you leave, we will put everything together. I said, uh-oh, now this is really different. So that's what happened. And then when the final outcome was, and then I hear in vocals and all kinds of little percussion and different sounds. So I'm just kind of playing it by ear. Seems like all the fans, they love it. So that's what counts.
Lonnie, if someone else had called you, was the reason that you weren't recording that you were retired from recording, or was it because nobody had called lately?
Oh, no, that wasn't the problem. Because, I mean, it was getting all kinds of calls from London and everywhere.
So why this one?
That's an interesting question. I guess it just fit. And I was in America, and it was just before that pandemic hit. So, because after that hit, I just really kind of canceled everything. But that's an interesting question. I don't know. It's just from talking to Drew, and he said, we record you, and then we're going to do a concert, and we're going to make sure everything is, first class ticket, nice hotel, all that. And so it's sometimes you just kind of play everything by ear or just to see, what would happen.
It's a lot of trust.
You asking some great questions. Right. Because it's hard to trust in the music industry. Because, I kept turning them down in the beginning because, like that word, because the music, the art of music is fantastic, but the business of music, that is very tricky. So I guess it was just supposed to happen.
So you got in there. What did they tell you to do? What did they have already, and what did they need from you?
That's the interesting question. When we got to the studio and Drew introduced me to Adrian and Ali, and they just had little ideas, and they said, we want you to just go ahead on and develop them, and just play, and that's what happened. It sort of reminded me of when I did the first recording with Miles Davis, I guess on the corner. And it was three keyboard players, myself, Herbie Hancock, and I forget the other young man. And what Miles did, he just put everything together after it was all finished. Him and Teal, they made arrangements. So recording with Adrian and them and Ali, and they said, we'll add to it when it's all finished. And that's what happened. And then the vocals came on when I finally heard the final result. And I'm getting great feedback. I wanted to see what the fans going to be able to relate to it from the way I used to, go in the studio and record.
I mean, I imagine if you had signed a record deal with, the label that was calling you from Amsterdam or London or whatever, they'd have said, come to Amsterdam, come into our studio. We'll have a band there. Mm. Maybe it's people that maybe it's whoever the talented people are locally, right? Mm-hmm. You'd sit down and they'd say, an A&R person would say, hey, how about these 10 songs?
Right.
You'd say, sure, maybe you would bring a couple. Right. And you'd just sit down and have a jazz session where everybody plays through all those songs. And this is a very different thing that you're describing.
Jesse, this is really a different thing, and but you never know, because I remember over 25 years ago, I got a call from EMI Records, and Guru Jazzmatazz, and sure. they called and they said, okay, we'll fly you to New York, and we're doing jazz meets rap or rap meets jazz, and we're going to use a different jazz artist on each cut. Donald Byrd was on one cut, Roy Ayers on another cut, Branford Marsalis was on another song. said, we want you to do this song. Because anyone who's talking that crap will surely get his. I'm not the one to act flashy. Because, man, where I be at, we don't have to be classy. Down the back streets, down the back streets, down the back streets. So I went to New York, and I just did it and didn't think anything of it. And 25 years later, people are calling for interviews. Some of it's a classic. So I'm kind of looking at this situation. It's really different. But I'm getting all kinds of great feedback. So it's, like you said, it was a lot of trust.
Much more to get into with Lonnie Liston-Smith. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Carvana, on a mission to make car buying more convenient and affordable than ever before. In minutes, you can browse thousands of options under $20,000. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to get started.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Lonnie Liston-Smith. He's a jazz pianist and keyboard player who worked with Miles Davis and Pharoah Sanders, among many, 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 many others. He's also a solo musician who's recorded about a dozen of his own records. His latest, which is the first in 25 years, just came out. It's called Jazz is Dead 17. Let's get back into our conversation. Let's talk a little bit about your childhood. Your father was a touring musician. He was a harmony singer in a gospel group.
Oh, yeah. There was a Harmonizing Four, and they went all over the world. And he had a very beautiful tenor voice, played four-string guitar. And then, of course, my two younger brothers, they inherited his beautiful tenor voice. You know, Donald, you heard him on all my records, expansions and everything. And then the middle brother, Ray Smith, he started a group, the Jarmels, and they had a big hit record, A Little Bit of Soap, you know, Wash Away Your Tears. And that was my middle brother, Ray Smith. So, but only thing I can sing is the bass. I didn't inherit a beautiful tenor voice, so I just sang through the piano. And then, you know, in high school, I went over to my friend's house one day, and his father was into jazz, and he was playing this beautiful record. I said, "What is that?" He said, "That's Charlie Parker playing Just Friends." And I said, "What is he doing?" He said, "He's doing, you know, jazz improvisation," and it just sounded so beautiful. I said, "Well, that's what I want to do." And then I just started listening to, like I said, you know, Art Tatum, Oscar Peterson, Earl Gardner, Charlie Parker, you know, all the great masters, and just kept growing from there.
Let me ask you about your dad when you were a kid. So you mentioned your dad played the guitar. There weren't a lot of guitars in harmony groups at the time. It was a relatively, it was consequential that he played the guitar. And, you know, when you were a kid, gospel music was changing and your dad's music was kind of in between. Mm-hmm. Like I said, he was playing the guitar. They were a little zippier than the stuff that came before, which was pretty, they could say, flat-footed. It involved standing still and singing really careful harmonies.
Oh, right.
And serious songs. But he also wasn't singing the kind of gospel music that I think people imagine when they imagine gospel music now, mm-hmm. which involves a lot of moving and clapping and jubilation.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of medium. So did you think he was cool when you were a kid?
Oh, you mean my father? Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Dad, he was fantastic. because he loved all kinds of music. That was an amazing thing about him. And because when they did the Apollo Theater, then after they finished, he would go to up there. I think it was Savoy, or they had this famous drummer, and he had a 5-piece band, and my father would go and listen, and he would come back and tell me all the stories. He loved great singers, and we used to sit in the basement and listen to. And back then, oh man, way back then, it was like the radio was. That's how you discovered music. And he was always encouraging. So you couldn't ask for a better situation.
I imagine he was out on the road for long stretches of time, though. He was probably driving and out for months.
Oh yeah, but my father wasn't driving because we were all. It was amazing. I guess I never mentioned it, but my father, my grandfather, and a couple of my uncles. It's amazing. All were born with congenital cataracts, but they were always on the road, and and I think they had this Chrysler car that was driving all over the road, and that's a little bit different, that's something I never wanted to do, just be on the road all the time like that, in the cars and things like that. But they were constantly on the road doing that, and that was it.
Do people come through your house when they were on tour?
Oh, that was another thing, because now the gospel groups, they had gospel festivals in all the cities. So my father and them was at they would have the gospel festival in Richmond, Virginia at the Mars. That's what they called it. And, the big concert hall. And so all the gospel groups would come in. I met, Sam Cooke and the Soul Searers, the Dixie Hummingbirds. And then I just found out Chris Love's grandfather was singing with the Dixie Hummingbirds. I didn't know that, but I just met all of them. And then Sister Rosetta Tharpe, because I heard her when I was a little kid, because she moved to Richmond because she was crazy about the Harmonizing Four. I heard her play, and then she was playing guitar. I said, wow, she's really playing different. But then years later, when I went to London, all the rock groups called her the mother of rock and roll. I said, wow, okay. But I was around all these gospel artists all my life when I was a little kid, but I just took it for granted. Like I say, it was all music.
Well, I want to hear a little bit of your dad's group, The Harmonizing Four.
Oh, okay.
This is actually from the 60s. This is a live recording of We're Crossing Over.
Yeah.
They sound pretty good.
Oh, right. Oh, man, that's... And they had some very famous bass singers also. And because I remember when I was doing a concert in Detroit back in the day, the bass singer from the Temptations came by, and he said, oh, man, I should listen to your father's group, because they had these great bass singers also. And, Jesse, like I said, it was... I was just doing music 24/7, and that's all I was interested in.
How old were you when your brother's record hit?
Oh, sure, I can't remember, but I'd already, I was already out there, and as soon as I finished high school, oh man, I got out of Richmond. I was heading to New York. But luckily, I went to Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. So I'm glad I did. And so, because that's when I met, because Gary Bartz, we started hanging out because he lived right there in Baltimore. And But see, with my brothers, the Jarmels, I think they had this song, A Little Bit of Soap, much later. And actually, I became a member of the Roar Theater Band, because at that time, they would do the Apollo Theater in New York for 1 week. Then they would do the Howard Theater in Washington, D.C. for another week. Then they come to Baltimore and do the Roar Theater. And I think it was one theater in Chicago, maybe in Philly. And they would do these a week at a time. And so I played behind the Jarmels once when they came through, because I was in the Roar Theater Band.
I just looked it up. That record came out in 61. So you were about 21 years old.
Oh, okay. Great.
Did you play the keys in the marching band?
Get out of here.
Just pushing the piano?
Oh, man, that's a good one. Band back then. Okay, so I want to get in the marching band. And so the band leader said, everybody wants to play trumpet and saxophone. They said, I need some tuba players. Nobody wants to play the tuba. I said, look, I want to be in the band, so I'm gonna play. I said I'll learn how to play the tuba, but Jesse, back then, those were real tubas. Those big, heavy metal instruments. I mean, they were like the ones today, but I didn't care. I just wanted to be in the marching band. So I was in the marching band at Armstrong High School and at Morgan, you know. And it was fun because, you know, you play for all the football games and all the different marches they had. Oh, I remember when I was in the band at Morgan, shoot, we played for one of the, was it the Baltimore Colts, I think, then. Played at one of their games and, you know, it was just all music.
And you were dragging around a tuba the whole time?
Hey, that's it. I mean, I wanted to be in the band and... But it was a good experience.
No, so, we're talking about we're not ending this conversation. We're talking about tubas for a minute.
Uh-oh.
Did you ever play the tuba professionally? Did you ever have occasion to bring out a tuba on a record?
Oh no. Shoot. I would have to learn all over again.
Were you ever just at the Village Vanguard one night and there was a tuba lying there and you said, "Oh, I could toot a little something on this."
Okay, all right, you're pretty good. No, but I tell you one thing, I wasn't aware of how important the tuba really was. And I wasn't aware of the tuba in New Orleans and all those great tuba players because, you know, they didn't have bass. The tuba player was the bass player. And I wasn't aware of that when I was in school doing the tuba. So I don't know what might have happened.
What was it like when you showed up in New York?
When I showed up in New York, I was just pure innocent, excited, and just ran down to, you know, Birdland, the original Birdland. It was still open. And, I mean, I didn't know, just went there and started hanging out and listened to all, you know, all the artists. But one thing I remember, I was just there and all of a sudden this complete stranger just walked up to me and said, and put a book in my hand. He said, you know, I think you're looking for this. I said, okay. And it was John Gilmore, you know, he played with Sun Ra. And the book was The Mysticism of Sound. And that started a whole new, you know, search, you know. Because I even wrote a song in Searching for Truth and things like that.
I interviewed one time the percussionist Ayrton Moreira. And he told me about showing up in New York. And, of course, he had come from Brazil.
Oh, boy.
And what was amazing to me is... And I pressed him on this to make sure that he was telling the literal truth and not giving me a broader interpretation of the truth. But he was like, yeah, when I came from Brazil, I brought my clothes and a suitcase full of percussion instruments.
Right.
Just one. He's like, I had one suitcase and it was full of percussion instruments and I just carried it around until someone let me play with them.
Oh, I mean, yes. I mean, back then, I mean, that was real New York. You know, but when you got to New York, it, for some reason, all the pianists, when they came to town, we all ended up with Betty Carter. You know, as for, I don't know how she found all the new young pianists. So that was a great situation. Then you could, because I started working with a lot of singers, and of course, you know, you start working with Betty Carter, and then Joe Williams, Dakota Staten, and then you know, actually, you know, your name is getting out there, and people are hearing you. But working with Betty Carter was really interesting because she approached music as the same way a horn player would approach music. So playing with her was almost like, you know, she wanted to be like a horn player with her voice. So, and then eventually you start getting calls, you know, Rosalind Roland Kirk call, and then later on Max Roach. But when you first get there, that was a different world.
Did you see something that you were good at? Did you have a rep? Did you think there was something that you could do that other people couldn't do or that you were particularly strong in?
No, because I was just playing, you know, because, you know, the main thing, I tell the young artists the same thing, you know. When I was working on Art Blakely, I met Monk, and Monk was saying, you know, you have to find your own sound. And so I wasn't, and back then, you know, we didn't have Berklee School of Music and things like that. So you had to develop your own sound, and I was just developing the things that I heard inside of me, you know, and manifesting them through the piano. But I noticed when Farrell and I were together, the last record we did was Thimby, you know, Farrell's record Thimby. And I discovered the Fender Rhodes piano. And I think I really developed a sound that, you know, on the Fender Rhodes piano that no one else developed. So I can say that because when I was working with Miles, I saw Miles had all these pedals hooked up to his trumpet. And I said, well, I now wonder if I do the same thing and hook all these pedals up to the Fender Rhodes. And it worked. Just came up with a whole, I guess what you call it, cosmic sound. And I wrote Astral Traveling right in the studio the first time I touched the Fender Rhodes when we were in California doing Thimby.
Well, let's hear the title track from Thimby, the Pharoah Sanders album, on which my guest Lonnie Liston Smith plays keyboards. Such a beautiful record.
Oh, great. Yeah, because that's the record Astral Traveling was on. And because I noticed I went inside the piano to get that string effect in the beginning. So that's good.
Tell me what you mean by that for people who don't know about how pianos work, such as myself.
Oh, you know, the grand piano, it's kind of fixed. Because, you know, the guitarists, the bass players, the drummers, the vocalists, the horn players, they can slide notes and get different effects. But when you play in the grand piano, it's hard to do that. So that's some of the things I try to do on the grand piano is try to get the effect, you know, that other people can do, even with vocalists. Because if you notice, in Western music, we have 12 notes, but there's more notes, you know, you got the whole note, then you got a half note. But in other, when you start traveling, there's notes in between that.
So you said you went inside the piano?
Oh, when I went inside the piano, like, you know, you heard it in the very beginning. You just swipe across the string part of the piano inside the where the strings are.
I thought it must be a harp or something when I was listening to it. That's you. When you say go inside the piano, that's not pianist talk for some other special thing. That's literally physically, that's you playing the piano strings with your hand.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's it. I do that a lot of times. You know, you can, if I was near the keyboard, I could really show you more, but we're not near a keyboard. That's it.
That must have been exciting then to get your hands on electric pianos where you could modulate their sound through means other than just that key and that hammer and those pedals, that you could add electronic alterations or, you know.
Oh, that's it. I mean, because even on a lot of the keyboards, there's a little knob that you can use to actually bend the note. So that's a whole nother world. But like I said, the way I try to approach the electric keyboards is a lot of pianists approach the electric keyboards the same way you approach the grand piano. But that's a different instrument, different color altogether. And so when I first heard the Fender Rhodes in that studio that day and I started messing with the knobs, the song just came. The creator just gave me this beautiful song, and Farrell and everyone ran over, said, "Well, what are you doing?" I said, "I don't know. I'm just composing." And they said, "Well, we got to record it. That is really beautiful." And they said, "What are you going to call it?" And at that time, I was studying astral projection, you know, where, you know, you can leave your body and float all over the world. But that's easier said than done, though. And I said, "Well, it sounds like we're floating here all over the world. Let's call it astral traveling." And but for a lot of keyboard players, you can't approach the electric keyboard the same way you approach the grand piano.
Well, let's hear the version of Astral Traveling from your first album, which was called Astral Traveling.
Oh, okay.
You listen to something like that, it's easy to see why they call spiritual jazz spiritual jazz.
Oh, yeah. And I was still with Miles, and but we were off, and Bob Thiel called and said, "Man, it's time for you to do your record." And because everyone is, you know, talking about you, you know, all over the world. I said, "Okay." And I just, you know, I had Buddy Arroyo playing tablas. So, you know, he's from India. Then I had Mtume playing percussion. And so that was it. You're trying to get this universal sound, because when you start traveling, you find out that music is the only universal language, because you can play with musicians, you can't speak to each other verbally, but once the music starts, you know, everything is great.
There's also a breadth to it. You know, it's expansive feeling. When you hear it, I can only imagine what it's like to play.
Oh, that's it. I mean, when you start playing and, you know, you just keep on expanding, and it's almost like you, that's what I'm saying, music really can heal people, because you can just feel like you just, like you're in paradise or nirvana or for lack of in heaven, or, you know, it's fantastic. Because I remember You know, Miles said something one time, and I think, you know, she said, you know, how are you going to practice the unknown? Once you start playing, you have to just keep going, and you don't know what's coming. But, I mean, it's just beautiful, you know, when you can do that.
It's also mesmeric. I mean, it is, it doesn't usually have that, you know, dancing in the aisles quality of a revival, right? But it does have that same effect, which is that you are drawn into it in a way that makes you feel like you are leaving your body, right? That you enter a different space.
Ah, that's pretty good, Jesse. That's it. I mean, because it's, so what I did was, you start doing research and you start studying other worldwide religions and philosophies. And so I just expanded on the beginning of, you know, the gospel and the blues and all that. Because all religions and all philosophies, I mean, everybody's saying the same thing. They want peace, harmony, love, and you know. And so when I did expansion, that's the first time I wrote lyrics, and I was saying, you know, well, why are we fighting and why is all the conflict worldwide when we all want the same thing? And so I was trying to manifest that through the music. And then I did a record called Renaissance, and I put on the album cover, you'll see all the symbols that represent every religion in the entire world. But when you look at what's going on today, you say, wow, you know, trying to bring peace, harmony, and all this, you know, to the world, it's not as easy as you think it is.
Well, let's take a listen to Expansions from 1975. My guest, Lonnie Liston Smith. So your first album with your name on the cover came out, you know, 10, 12 years into your career as a professional musician. 1975, you're 15-ish years into your career as a professional musician, and you have a hit record in a kind of music where it had been a long time since there had been a bunch of hit records. You know, it was like, it was a new thing for there to be hit jazz records in the mid-70s, you know. Obviously, there were lots of hit jazz records up until the 50s or so, and still jazz, you know, jazz vocal hit records a little while after that. But like, for real, I can't imagine that when you were making Pharoah Sanders albums, that you were like, man, in a few years, I'll crack the pop charts.
Yeah, that's what happened was, okay, when I did it, that's the first time I wrote lyrics. And that's why I said I was trying to, you know, expand on, you know, everything I learned growing up and try to make it a whole universal concept so everyone could understand it. Because, you know, we're all one, but it's, like I said, easier said than done. And so what Expansions was like, okay, on the bottom, I said, well, because, you know, we're all influenced by James Brown. I mean, you know, I mean, once you hear James, I mean, that's all that funk he laid on you and rhythm. So I said, okay, we're going to put the rhythm on the bottom, and then I'm going to have meaningful lyrics. Expand your mind. And, you know, because most of the lyrics were people crying, my baby done left me, and all that kind of stuff. I said, no, we have to. Some very positive, uplifting lyrics. And then we're still going to be using the same jazz chords that we use straight ahead music, and we're still going to do improvisation. And Jesse, when the record came out, the whole world said, "Well, that's what we've been, that's what we want, or that's what we've been waiting for." And it just took off.
We'll finish up with Lonnie Liston Smith after a quick break. When we return, as I mentioned before, his tracks have been sampled so many times in hip hop and electronic music. He'll talk about the songs that caught him by surprise. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There is some truth in that.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is jazz keyboardist Lonnie Liston Smith. His latest record, Jazz is Dead 17, is out now. So your records have been very extensively sampled, both the ones that, are under your name and the ones that you played on. Is there a record that you heard that had a piece of you playing where it really caught you by surprise, where the way that it was used or the way that it was transformed or the way that it was contextualized caught you by surprise?
Well, the thing that really caught me by surprise was, of course, now they sample expansions. I understood that. But all of a sudden, they start sampling A Garden of Peace. And that really caught me by surprise, because A Garden of Peace, when I was in the studio, I told Bob, I said, "Bob, I just want to do something, something beautiful." And, because record companies, you got to have a hit record because that makes everyone happy, and the record companies. So I said, "I want to do something beautiful." So I played A Garden of Peace on the grand piano, acoustic piano. Then I overdubbed the Fender Rhodes, to add a lot of colors and things like that. But years later, everyone started sampling Garden of Peace, and the younger generation, they really love it. So I've talked to the younger kids, 16, 17, 18 on up. I said, "Well, what do y'all like about A Garden of Peace?" They say it's just so peaceful. And so I said, "Okay, well, that's what I was trying to do." And so I guess during this day and time, everyone is looking for peace, because the world's kind of going through a lot of changes right now. And that when this, all these samples of Garden of Peace really surprised me.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Garden of Peace by Lonnie Liston Smith. And then why don't we hear a little bit of the Jay-Z classic that sampled it, Dead Presidents.
In the finest click, live out my dreams until my heart gives out and bow and grave. You know exactly what this is about, what y'all mean. Handling since a teen, I can shout like the point guard off your favorite team. Without doubt, my life ain't rosy.
So I read, and you can tell me if this is true or not true, but I read that you were voted both friendliest and best dressed in high school. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's in the yearbook. That was it.
Tell me what you were wearing.
You went back then, I guess. You had the tie and shirt, and that's a nice picture of us standing outside, a whole bunch of us standing outside talking to the principal. And I guess I was always into dressing And now, I wear all these beautiful colors in the shirts, and I call them my cosmic shirts. And so, I mean, because, back then in the 70s, had the Fender Rhodes, and I had a cover over the Fender Rhodes with a lot of sequins and on the front of it. So when the light hit it, the colors would just bounce out into the audience. And because, color and sound, it all goes together. And so, Jesse, maybe I was just too cosmic. I was trying to do it all.
Well, Lonnie Liston Smith, I sure appreciate your time. Thank you very much for talking with me.
All right. Hey, it's been a pleasure.
Lonnie Liston Smith. His latest album is Jazz Is Dead 17. It's fantastic. Here's one more song from it called A New Spring. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. Here at my house, I bought one of those tumbling compost bins. Then I realized when it came, I'd have to put it together. So I'd have to put the dang thing together. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellows at Maximum Fun are Tabitha Myers and Brianna Paz. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Special thanks this week to Dina Weinstein for recording our conversation with Lonnie Liston Smith out in Virginia where he lives. Our interstitial music is composed and provided to us by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Our theme song is by the Go Team. It's called Huddle Formation. Thanks to them and Memphis Industries, their label, for sharing it with us. Bullseye is also on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. Find us there. Give us a follow. We will share with you all of our interviews. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator for Planet Money podcast on NPR.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.